Fire up your Harleys. It's Punk News Podcast 504. We're heading down to Sturgis to hang out and talk punk rock and see Nickelback and Bone Thugs and Harmony and Trapped and also Smash Mouth.
You wish they could afford Nickelback down there.
And welcome back to Punk News Podcast. This is 504. We're all firing up our Harleys and getting ready for Sturgis or coming back from Sturgis. Adam, did you have a good time to Sturgis this year? I mean, I had a pretty good time.
I did. Is that a fish?
And Tom, how about you, man?
So that's a sturgeon, I believe.
Oh.
Yeah, I had a great time, man. I saw some of the floppiest mammaries I've seen in a long time. The real old school, you know, take the bra off and those suckers just hit the knees. I like it. Good time.
Fill me in here. Is this event something one would know about if not the part of a story about idiots being idiots?
It's a huge biker. It's a huge biker thing. It happens every year. I mean, it's massive, hundreds of thousands.
It's like 80 years old too. And if you ride a motorcycle, it's like it's the fest for motorcycle guys. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, see, I just and I, probably I don't know.
Probably a better time. But yeah, it's the acts available. I think the lineup this year, certainly the acts available to them were not top shelf to begin with. But this is essentially a rally where their idea of a top shelf act is like 38 special, you know.
Well, we'll get into Sturgis in a little while. So let's just jump right into the podcast. Listen, we're joking around, we're laughing, but we actually have two sad stories we have to hit first. First story is Riley Gale of Power Trip. Quite surprisingly, suddenly passed away. He was 34. Power Trip within the past 3 or 4 years has been like the neo thrash band. I mean, like they are extremely popular, and they put out an album called Nightmare Logic, which a lot of people thought was like the album. You know? The band issued a statement that basically said, "It's with great sadness we must announce that our lead singer and brother Riley Gale has passed away last night. He was a friend, brother, and son." And they add more, and they at the end they say we would appreciate your privacy at this time. So this one was a real shocker. No one saw this coming, especially since Power Trip is fame-wise at their most famous thing to date. But not only that is like they're like the thrash band, like any modern thrash band, everyone's like looking up to them thrash band-wise. So this was really surprising.
I know that those guys came from like a hardcore punk background too, and you could sense that in their music. But I know they had a lot of punk friends. So it's definitely more so than, you know, maybe a Municipal Waste or something who's doing the retro thrash thing.
Well, I mean, Gale was just on that Masterpiece Machine record that he recorded with Mike Halchuk and Jonah Falco Fucked Up. So like there was
I don't know what that is, but okay.
No, it was like an EP that they put out, and it was more like Nine Inch Nails or Ministry kind of stuff than say like Cro-Mags or whatever. But like they put out an EP. It came out on like Triple B, the big hardcore label out there. And they never played a show as like a live unit or anything because of COVID. And it was, you know, one of those things where they were saying like, you know, when everything goes back to normal, then, you know, Masterpiece Machine will finally get out there and play shows. But yeah.
Were you able to see them, John?
Masterpiece Machine, they never played a show.
Power Trip.
Yeah, I think I'm almost sure I saw Power Trip at one of the Decibel Fests. Yeah, I think I saw them. Or maybe I saw them at Underground Arts in Philadelphia. My one friend was a big fan.
I saw them twice, but it was both at the beginning of like a 4-band bill where they got like a half hour at the beginning. I never saw them like really do their thing in like a small club. So it was always like a bigger venue. But they were cool. I dug them. I have both their albums. And I know they were working on a new one, so I'm curious. You know, as a guy who's reached, you know, who's 20 years older than the cool rock and roll age to die, whenever I hear about a young guy dying, I always feel sick to my stomach, and I have no idea what the cause of death is. All I know, you know, for all I know, he had an aneurysm or something and died. But the older I get, the more it bothers me. Like, I have this fear every time somebody dies that they off themselves, and it bothers me more and more. And like I said, I'm not speculating that that's what happened to him. I have no idea, but man, it's like Riley. Like, that's what people my generation name their kids. Like nobody my age is named Riley, right? So he always feels young. But anyway, I don't know what happened, but I feel a little sad about it. I have no personal connection to the guy, but
I hear you, Tom. It is really sad. I mean, it's sad when anybody dies early, or when anybody dies really. But it is somewhat.
Yeah. I've come to appreciate certain people dying more and more as I get older. But anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
Fair enough. It is somewhat depressing, or I don't exactly know how to phrase it. It's like you can be like you can be super famous. Like let me put it this way. I know a lot of bands, older bands and younger bands, like. It really eats away at them that they're not more famous. They're not making tons of money off. And sure, everybody likes making money. But the number of bands that have been like really popular and miserable, or miserable and the next step, like, it's astounding. So I think like a lot of bands, it'd be cool to be more famous and make more money, but that's not necessarily your key to happiness. And actually, it might be more miseries.
Well, Kurt Cobain, dude. Kurt Cobain made so much money and was so successful after one album that he had total creative control over his music, unheard of at that time. And he put a shotgun in his mouth. So, and once again, I'm not speculating about Riley Gale. I have no idea what killed Riley Gale, but I do get a sinking feeling every, you know, it's same with the Towns Earl guy. I have no idea what happened to him, but you know, I don't think that's been really shit either, but you're afraid. So first you say to yourself, God, I hope it's not suicide. Please don't be suicide. And then it's like, oh, please don't be overdose. Please don't be overdose. You're like saying a silent prayer that it's like an embolism or something, you know? It's just, I don't know. It bothers me more as I get older.
I hear you. I mean, it's sad. I don't know if there's an answer for it, you know? Yeah.
And then you got the next guy we're going to talk about, who's on the opposite end of the spectrum, who literally abused his body, like used his body like a dumpster for 40 years and still lived to be 70, you know?
Well, actually, I have a theory about that might be entirely wrong, but let's talk about that. Walter Lohr of Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers, and later Walter Lohr of the Waldos, and he was in a whole bunch of other bands. He's on the seminal LAMF album, which is Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers' first and technically only album, and it is a ripper. He quite surprisingly passed away last week, and he passed away from complications related to cancer, and he was only diagnosed in July 2020. So it was a relatively quick span between diagnosis and passing away. Even more sad is he's the last surviving member of the Heartbreakers. So all
classic heartbreakers are
all passed away now.
I was going to say, because Richard Hell is actually technically still alive, so you'd have to say it's like the classic Heartbreaker lineup. All the classic Heartbreaker lineup.
Right? Well, Richard Hell isn't on any of the recording. I think he's on a demo or two, but he's not on any of the albums.
Yeah, but he was like the original. He was like the original bass. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Because there was a bunch of people that came and went over the years, but from the classic lineup that made the record. Yeah, he was the last one.
So I know a lot of people were surprised. Nobody knew he was sick, and apparently he didn't really know he was sick till July, which is sad. I saw him at a dive bar. Actually, stepping back, what a lot of people don't know about Walter Lohr is he was actually like a really successful stockbroker or something related to Wall Street. Like
I read that after his death. Yeah.
So like after the Heartbreakers, I guess he got involved in stocks and bonds or something in like related to that. And he was actually like a really successful guy. And people didn't even know he was Walter Lohr. I mean, he's still Walter Lohr, but like people we work with didn't know he was like this crazy rock and roll guy that was involved in the heroin CBGB scene. You know? I saw Walter Lohr in the Waldos, I guess about 9 months ago or so. And it was in a, it was a little, I'm so not lying, it was a little
playing. They were still playing dive bars like 9 months ago.
It's this weird scene in Philadelphia in that, there's this dive bar in Philadelphia called Connie Rick Rack. And in a way, it's cool because it's a dive bar. It's like cheap to get in. And but on the other end, it's like really depressing because most of the audience there are like 50 and 60, which is cool. But they dress like they're like 19 and 20 year old punks, you know? And like the greatest thing to them is like getting drunk. And it's kind of a bummer, you know? and the shows are never that well promoted, and you always see, like, I think the turnout could have been a lot better than it was, and there was only like 30 or 40 people there, maybe, and I don't know how anybody made any money at all. And so he played, and it was cool. It sounded good, but it didn't seem like he was having a good time. But maybe that's just because he's a New York cat, and they maybe never seem like they're having a good time. And the whole time he kept referring to Johnny Thunders as Johnny Blunder. And he did the joke once, and it was kind of funny, but like kept doing it. And it's like, man, it's been like 30 years. Maybe let the anger, like, maybe let the anger like go. You know what I mean?
That's
go ahead, funny. Tom.
Well, no, I was going to say, it's like mean-spirited, but the truth of the matter is he left right after the record came out, like in 77, 78, but they played off and on for years. I mean, they played, I think, even 91, the year Johnny died. He still played with them occasionally. I don't think there was a real estrangement
That whole New York Dolls heartbreaker scene is kind of weird that way, because, like, even though the New York Dolls broke up because they hated each other, like David Johansen and Johnny Thunders, or David Johansen and Syl Sylvain would still play together like once in a while, or Arthur Killer Kane, you know.
They do all these small little reunions of, yeah, it's weird, man. They were, you know, oh, such lurid tales. But anyway, yeah, it's sad. It's a bummer. There's a version of that album. I think it's a Euro import on Jungle Records, and I actually have it on like double CD, and I have the vinyl. But it's such a good mix, because that LAMF never really, the original mix was notoriously bad. So there's called like Lost 77 mix that I've been blasting on vinyl in the house, much to the chagrin of my wife and kids. So it's a great press if anybody's looking for a good version of that record. The gatefold.
If you don't have LAMF, you definitely should get that album, because it's a freaking classic. If you get the CD, there's a CD version that has both versions on double CD with both tracks. That's the version to get.
So that mix is the one that I have in the vinyl. I actually have the CD too, because, you know, I'm a knob. So, but yeah, that one has a ton of extra tracks and alternate takes and stuff. But yeah, it's definitely a classic, man. You know, probably a little underrated on the like 77 classic list, you know, but probably worth mentioning up there with, you know, the Pistols and all that stuff. So good stuff.
Yeah, fair enough. Adam, anything to contribute about Walter Lohr?
No. I'm good. You guys have said what needs to be said. It's
all right, Tom. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Adam.
I don't know where I was going with that. No, I mean, the age disparity between these two is definitely something that sits with me here.
Yeah,
and
literally double. Yeah.
But you just like you look at someone who's just like, you know, lived that hard rock and roll lifestyle and abused the shit out of their body over the years, and how, like, what is the rhyme or reason that they got that old? They got that old where basically, like, regardless of the cause of death, they died of old. Then, like, how does that work?
Well, right? he got out of the life. I think there was definitely a drug and alcohol issues in the past, but I think he got out of it relatively young, as opposed to, like, Johnny Thunders, who had enough, you know, when he died in 1991, he had enough, like, methadone in his system to kill an elephant or whatever, you know. So I think he kind of avoided carrying it into his old age or whatever.
I don't know. I'm hoping there's a genetic thing to this, because like my grandfather was 98 when he died, and that guy like smoked a pipe his whole life and ate, you know, pretty much french fries and chocolate, and that's it. And just like, yeah, I don't know. There was no scientific reason that guy should have lived that long. So
there you go. So you want to play Johnny? You want to do a song, Johnny? Should we do a Johnny Thunder song?
Let's hear it, Tom.
Let's do. Okay, I think this is appropriate because he was the last of the Heartbreaker standing, and I know he contributed songwriting on this track. So let's do a song from LAMF. This is All By Myself.
that was Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers doing All By Myself with Walter Lohr, who arguably wrote a lot. Well, not arguably, did write a lot of those songs, but there was famously friction between the band members as to who wrote what with regards to that. Anyways, let's get into some old school punk bands that are still around. First of all, Fear, which I is technically still around. I saw Fear at the last Punk Rock Bowling in their original lineup, and that was cool. Like, I don't think people really appreciate it. They're like, it's the original Fear. And they
was it really?
The original,
I guess I didn't realize it was the original lineup that was at Punk Rock Bowling a couple years ago.
It was rad. It was, like, super rad. But they're re-releasing their second album, which is not the original lineup. And the second album is called More Beer. And it's got the original album on one CD. On another CD, it's the album remixed and remastered by the band Spit Sticks, and it also has unreleased demo tracks. And so if you're a Fear fan, this is definitely cool because the original CD version is really not that great. But the question with this release is, like the first Fear album is a stone cold classic. More Beer, yeah, not as much as a classic. So should this be remixed, remastered, because maybe there is a good album under there, or maybe just junk that people are trying to spruce up, you know?
The production choices on More Beer were questionable at best. It sort of sounded like they were trying to make a Van Halen record or something. And while it had some good songs on it, it's nowhere near the classic that the first album is. And I don't know, John, I'm kind of burned out on, as a collector of this stuff, I'm kind of getting burned out on too deluxe of a treatment of something. Because you notice, like Anthrax Persistence of Time is 30 years old this year, and they're reissuing it as a 4-LP set. It's like, why do I need to spend $80 on this reissue? I mean, give me a double LP, break it into three sides, and then give me maybe the very best extra track from the session. I don't need demo versions on vinyl and all this crazy crap. I mean, it's like, oh, here's the original demo version with no lyrics on vinyl. So who's listening to that? What do I need that for, John? Give me two records, stop. Don't give me these super crazy sets.
I think that's part of the cash in when you were a band that hits that status level where you are old enough and have at least enough respected material that you are considered to be from some quote unquote like classic era, is that you all of a sudden realize you have this like long tail where you can start cashing in on the things that people didn't really care about at the time. And I mean, it's going to be weird for me to bring this up because we always talk about doing a show about our appreciation of Latter Day Ramones records, but
we got to do that.
We do, right? But when they started doing the CD reissues of the Ramones stuff in the like the early 2000s, right, where they had those ones where they were all reissues, yeah, where they were like paper sleeved on like a paper sleeve with the CD case inside, and there were usually a couple discs, and there was a second disc like a bunch of live shit on it and whatever, right? Where so when they were going through like the first five or six records, like it made a lot of sense, but I always had this suspicion at the time, and maybe this is less of a concern now that I've decided I like a lot of that stuff. But when they start getting into like the back, not the, you know, into the dregs, are they going to keep up this level of like reissue production?
I think they just flat out quit doing them.
I think so.
Well, right? Actually, that's semi true. So the all the way up through what do you call it?
End of the century.
Subterranean Jungle. Beyond it. Okay. The Ramone estate themselves remastered and did about 2002, 2003, did a wonderful job with a ton of excellent bonus tracks, right?
Yeah.
Then in the UK, Captain Oi Records actually did some, but not all of the later day ones, with fewer but equally good bonus tracks, but more importantly, improved sound. And Adam, actually, I wasn't listening. Do you mean the 2003 reissues or like the 2017 reissues?
No, I'm thinking the 2003 reissues because that's when I would have been buying CDs. Yeah, right. So
they were just slipcover. At least the American versions were just like slipcover CD cases, but they were very well curated. Those were very well put together.
Right, did they do one of like Brain Drain?
No, but those were all on a different label.
That's not true. They did do that in the UK through Captain Oi.
Like, but Braingram was the last Sire record.
You're right. That was still on Sire. But I think they, no, I don't think they got that far though.
Right. But like, I mean, but I guess gonna, the,
like a deluxe version of Acid Eaters that has like four more bad covers on it.
Right. But I think that like you could, like if they decided that, you know what, we started this, we're going to keep it going and we're going to do the deluxe reissue of the whole catalog. At a certain point, like no one's going to shit on it too much because they're going to be like, all right, well, they're completing this set, I guess. So sure. So maybe Fear kind of falls into that category where like, you know, people are like, you know, no one really cares about More Beer, but hey, Fear is a classic band, so we'll give it to them. I feel like it's in the same way where, like, if they went and they did, like, a really lush, you know, reissue of Marquee Moon, then, you know, people would buy that because it's an incredible record. But are people going to go buy, like, a deluxe reissue of Adventure? Like, no. Yeah,
maybe.
But if it's all done up in the same way, I guess, like, You've somehow earned it. It's like an old band retirement, cashing in on some retirement funds.
I guess what I will say as far as More Beer goes is, as much as More Beer is certainly not anything near what the record is, it actually goes much further downhill after that. So maybe we should enjoy More Beer. So yeah, you know, listen, if people will buy it, they will make it. And what are we talking about, really? We're talking about 1,000 copies or something. It's not like we're pressing, you know, 500,000 of these things, right?
I mean, on the other hand, if people want to buy it, what do I care? You know what I mean? Exactly. You don't have to buy it.
And listen, here's the thing. Here's the thing for guys like you and I. People can go out right now and buy it for $40 or whatever, and then when they don't want it anymore, we'll scoop that sucker up for like $15 used.
Very true, and I appreciate that a great deal. But let's talk about a older band that I think is still doing pretty cool stuff. Dead Milkmen released a new 7-inch. The 7-inch is on the A side. It's a cover of Heaven 17's "We Don't Need This Fascist Groove Thing," and the flip side is an original track called "A Complicated Faith." Both tracks are somewhat unique for Dead Milkmen in that the A side is electronic influence, although it actually breaks down to a ska number, which I think is real cool, and the B side is almost totally electronic. This is the second and third new Dead Milkmen tracks since their EP from about 3 or 4 years ago. They also released another one on a compilation that was really quietly released. I thought it was going to suck, but actually I thought it was pretty good. Like I really liked the ska aspect. I thought it was funny and fun, and the flip side I thought was kind of a cool, you know, a New Order-ish type track. One thing I would be concerned about, I guess, is Rodney Anonymous, the main singer. He loves electronic music. And so there always is the fear, like, one band member's newest, you know, flame, like, overtaking everything else. And I would say that would be a problem with the 7-inch, but it's a good 7-inch, so I'm not complaining. I wouldn't want a whole album of electronic Dead Milkmen, but I do appreciate that they're doing different stuff and keeping it fresh. And I dug this track a lot, honestly.
I'm a big fan of this band. I have not listened yet.
It's kind of interesting how contemporary this song sounds. It sounds like it's chasing any particular trend, but in that it does not sound like the product of a like quote unquote veteran band at this point in their career. Like it sounds very, very current. Like it sounds like the kind of thing where like if some band came out of nowhere and released a song that was the equivalent of the Dead Milkmen covering this electronic song, like people would be into it. And it's cool. It's cool from that aspect. I mean, like it both proves, I think, that there's like still gas in the tank for Dead Milkmen, but it's also, it's pretty good in its own right.
And I got to say, John, on a totally different note, the $10 7-inch is killing me.
Yeah. I hear you, but that's the price. That really is the price. I mean, They cost like $6 or $7 to make now.
I know they do, but you better give me four songs then.
I hear that. Yeah. I mean, and that's the question is, if a 7-inch costs the same as a 12-inch, do we even want 7-inches anymore? You know,
they don't cost that much, but I get it. The price is up. I know some guys who make them, and I know what the cost is. And I know that $10 is not not that much of a profit on these things, but it's just, man, you're right. I guess I'd rather buy a, you know, 12 song $20 record than a, you know, two song $10. So
I will say, is un, Oh, go ahead, Adam.
I was talking to a label guy.
Love Seven Dragons.
Back before I put up my tape. I was discussing with a label guy about putting out, you know, 7 inches or whatever, and I was trying to come up with what made sense to do, and he had just
gone. What's the best way to waste money?
Yeah, like which way do you want to waste money? Like he had just gone and put out a 7-inch for a band that both me and him were really into, and he fully acknowledged. He's like this isn't going to make any money, and we all know it's not going to make any money. But I just really want to have a 7-inch from this band because all their stuff had been digital or whatever up until that point. So he's like, so I, as a collector, want to have one. And what I'm planning to do is just like throw a box of them in the bottom of my closet. And then in 20 years, when the rest of the world wakes up and realizes that this band was amazing, I'm going to flip them all for my retirement. And I was like, hey, that's
a good one. Yeah, either that or he'll be giving them away. People will forget because he didn't get them out there. But yeah, I wonder, you know, a lot of people are doing like the lathe cut thing now. So I wonder if that will eventually become an option in that same price range. I don't know.
What I really want to do, and I probably shouldn't say this out loud, but I'll say it. When you say things out loud, they tend to never come true. But for the next time when Punk News throws a show in, you know, 2042 or whatever it is, I actually want to like lathe cuts. Like you can make like 20 or 30 lathe cuts. So I'd love to like have
you
a lathe cut
that you can own. As few as you want, yeah.
And like only like come. This is the only place to get this lathe cut is at this show. I think that'd be so cool to do, you know.
But you'd probably have to sell them in like the $20 price point or something like that too.
Yeah,
if you're only making 30 of them,
like as a fan, if I go to a Melvin show and there's only 30 copies of this record, I'm paying $25 for it, like without even thinking. You know what I mean,
John? I met a guy last weekend who had the Melvin's collection. He literally spends $500 every time he goes to see the Melvin. He has all those $200, $300, $500 LPs, the ones that they press over their old records, and he and his wife.
Yeah.
I mean, just insane. I mean, I was super impressed. I'm pretty sure he was pleased to have people at his house that actually cared, but it was interesting. Anyway, I'm sorry. I digress. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, first of all, let's go mug them. Second of all, though, I mean, in a way, that is
cool. I don't know that I can find the house again, but I know what town it's in.
Like, if you're spending that much on just, I don't know, is that wasteful or is that buying cool art? I'm not sure. You know what I mean? Like,
listen, you know, it was his thing, you know?
I guess the question is, if he gets $500 worth of enjoyment out of it and he's not just buying it just to possess it, if he's getting joy out of it, then it's worth it.
So the thing is, all those records were going for at least, you know, people were flipping them on Discogs for a lot more than what they were, than the $200 or $300 that they were paying at the show.
Yeah, so. Well, with the Melvin's record specifically, that was the phenomenon about 7 years ago. So they kept raising the price of the records. So if you want to flip a Melvin's record now, you can maybe make like $20 or $30 off of it. And if you're throwing out $100, it's not worth the risk. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's not for me anyway. I'm not that high end of a collector, but anyway, it doesn't matter.
Well, listen, let's talk about other records that might be for collectors. I almost rhymed. Record collector. Three bands, and we're just going to blast through these three stories, and then any of you can comment on them as you like. They're reworking older material. The Queers are re-recording four songs from Back to the Basement, which was their 2003 Asia Man Records release. And on the flip side is the Jason's.
2010.
And the Stations, which are re-recording four of their older songs with Joe Queer as a sound engineer. The Bouncing Souls are releasing a new album, and it is basically just them radically reworking some of their older songs in a mostly acoustic fashion. The first single that they released from it was Coach on the Boardwalk, which was a radically different version of the song. Really, only the lyrics are the same, I would say. And then, for me, most interestingly, but I'll let you guys go first, is Ceremony remixed their last album, in the spirit world now, and the new version is the same vocal tracks. The music underneath the guitar, bass, and drums are almost all removed, and now it's all Gary Numan type synth music. And so a lot of people, a lot of different feelings on that. At point, man, what do you think of a band just kind of going back and reworking old tracks for new styles? And did any of these jump out at you?
In general, this is a thing that I would consider myself against. And I feel like the Bouncing Souls is a really good example of why you probably don't want to do this. At the very least, you don't want to do this, I think, as a product. Like, one of the things that I've always kind of liked is that sometimes bands will go into the studio, they'll record a song, they'll put it out on one of their big records or whatever, but then as they play it over the years, they start to develop it kind of like post-recording into something that is both more amenable to their live show, but maybe just a version of it that they prefer. And you know, it's almost frustrating as a fan because you might go to see them and you never really hear the studio version of that song anymore, but that's just not what that song is anymore to the band.
Or you see them a few times and you get used to the strange version that they play live because you see them enough.
Yeah, but I've come
and then they play the record at home and you're singing the version they play live.
Well, see, and I feel that being disappointed with not having the studio version is weak. And at the point where you really get into the groove with the band and you get on their wavelength and you're like, no, the superior version is the version that the band has figured out that they like. Then when you go into that, then you've reached some sort of like a different level of fandom now where you're kind of like you're vibing with what the band is doing right now. And I don't know, I appreciate that. It's kind of fun. So, I mean, I don't mind that and bands reworking material that way, because in that way, it's sort of like a living document. But to go into to make a studio product out of it feels like you're spinning your wheels, right? Like it feels like you're mining the nostalgia.
Makes you wonder why you're putting so much effort into that instead of putting out some new music. Are you
right?
Are you creatively bankrupt at this point?
Yeah, exactly. Or are you just trying to like milk people that are really into you? And like, and the Bouncing Souls, which is a band that I would never ascribe like an ill thought to, because I feel like those are very, very, very pure and happy people. But they are a band that has an incredibly fervent fandom, and that is the kind of fandom that I imagine would eat up a, you know, album that is reworking a bunch of existing material. So, and it's one thing for like a song, like let's say the Souls had like a version of Ghosts on the Boardwalk, which I mean, it's not one of my favorite songs of theirs in the first place, but like,
I was going to say hardly a highlight of their career.
Right. Yeah. But there's, have you seen the track list of this? Like there's a bunch of stuff from like Hopeless Romantic right. So
they're going to ruin them.
But let's say they had a version, right. That they loved. That was the new live version of this thing. Like, I don't know. There's other ways to do it than record like a whole album covering yourself.
Do a new four song, 7-inch. And put two new songs and two reworked old songs or something like that.
Or do some high quality live recordings of it and actually capture it the way that you're
playing. Well, they've already done a live EP, a double live album.
You're not dissuading me from the Bouncing Souls are mining their fan base for money with that comment then. So yeah, I don't know. That said, the ceremony thing. I am fucking into the ceremony thing. And it is potentially because a lot of the weirdo punk guys that I know seem to have like side projects or secondary careers as Gary Newman style synth people. So that this just like fits right into my listening habits these days. But yeah, I'm kind of into this. It is aggressively different enough that it is not on the same level as what the Souls are doing here, but. So I can buy ceremony doing it because it's so fucking different than what they would normally do. But yeah, the Souls thing is weak. Souls thing is weak to me. I mean, the synthwave thing is going to live or die whether or not you ever want to listen to a bunch of electronic new wave music. And I imagine that that is not a thing Tom wants to listen to.
No, I'm not too interested in either of those things, honestly. I'm most interested in the one where it's just these punk bands just banging out their old songs again. And the reason is just we had Joe Queer on Punk Till I Die. And I was kind of like, what are you doing with these re-recording these old albums? Is it because you want to get the masters away from Hopeless or whatever? But honestly, if he wasn't happy with the original recording of the Back to the Basement album, which I think is a bummer because I think that was actually a great, like Queer's comeback album. But he didn't like the sound of it. So he's been occasionally re-recording a song here and there. So at his own studio, so it's just
it's that different. they're kind of the same, you know?
Yeah. No, I agree. It's very subtle. It's not quite as muddy. It's a little, it's slightly different. I haven't heard the new versions of this, but I know they did. My buddy who has the record label in Indiana, he did the same thing, did a couple songs from the Back of the Basement album on the split I can't remember who the other band was. Doesn't matter. Bass and Badano, I think it was. But anyway, it doesn't matter. But yeah, and they did the same thing. So they slowly re-recording the whole album. And I do dig the Jasons too. They're kind of a gimmicky band where they play like a pretty good pop punk, but they all wear Jason masks and sing songs about serial killer stuff. So it's fun. But anyway, I will probably buy that $10 7-inch.
What?
Go ahead, Adam.
No, I was gonna say there was a band who was it that actually went and just like fully. There's a few bands I've done it where they've like just like went back and fully re-recorded.
Happy's done it like three times.
Queers did it with both their Hopeless record, which was Punk Rock Confidential and Beyond the Valley of the Queers. Is that what it's called, or Beyond? I can't remember. Anyway, it's not that uncommon. And a lot of these old 77 punk bands, actually a ton of them have done it, usually because they don't have rights to their own music. So they'll actually go through and like re-record the whole album, almost always badly. So then like if people want to use it for a movie or something, they could license it out and actually get a couple bucks. Like the Annie Norwood League, I know like 3 years ago, recorded the entire We Are the League album.
Well, no, you know what it was? It was Chicks Dig It. They went their very first record that they had out was like 1996.
Classic 77 punk.
Of no, Chicks Dig It. Just just like a more modern thing. Like their first record came out on Sub Pop, and they went back into the studio like a decade ago, maybe 15 years ago, and just like re-recorded the whole thing front to back in like, you know, probably in like a week, and then put it out again. And I just start trying to remember if that was one of those things where they're like, oh, we don't have the rights to this. But
the problem with that is you're always generally 9 times out of 10, you're going to like the one you heard first, even if the new one's better, because you can't really be completely unbiased listening to the new version.
Oh, the slightest note change would drive me insane.
Pretty much. And you know, I found that with different remixes to some of the Lookout catalog, they get different remixes. I'm like, oh, that guitar is too loud, you know, and it's real subtle things, and usually it won't drive you insane, but you will notice little things. So anyway, I don't know. I'm against all this stuff. I'm against it all.
Well, the thing there though too is like, it's a classic to the fans. So even if the band or the songwriter is like annoyed by it, it's like, I don't know if you're getting what you want if you re-record it as a studio. Like, the fans aren't going to be like, this is better. So, like, everybody's unhappy, you know?
Well, my band is so much better now. It's like, yeah, but the original band's sloppiness is what made it so magical. You can't just record, you know, how many people have you heard try to play Blitzkrieg Bop and do it badly? There was something magical about the way the Ramones played it. You can't just take people who are good musicians and have them play Blitzkrieg Bop with Pulse or Bones. It just doesn't work. So anyway, you know, sometimes it's the deficiencies that make the original recording so wonderful.
You know who enjoys this? You know who enjoys this? I figured out the person that is really pro this is the
Serial Killers?
No, well, maybe, but the
torture animals? Yes.
The studio engineer. Because think about it. His job is easy. Band's going to come in. They know the songs. They know what they're doing.
Maybe.
You got to sit down and press record and then collect your paycheck.
Hmm. Well,
yep. It's conspiracy.
Paradoxically, when a band does like their full album live, I definitely want that album. You know what I mean? So isn't that funny? It's a different feeling for some reason.
It is funny. And I don't think I agree with you, John, but I mean, whatever, you buy what you buy. You collect what you collect. But like, you know, because like,
Tom, I
love the
album.
No, I like to see them live. I just don't know that I need it on a record. Like, I love the NoFX album Ribbed. And I got the record, of course, and I got the CD and whatever else. But they put out a live version, a live and a die version of the Ribbed album. I feel no need to buy that, even though it's got the modern lineup and stuff. I'm never going to choose that on the turntable over the original album.
If it's a A versus B though, sometimes you just want a different flavor. You know, Judas Priest has a live version of British Steel, and it's friggin' awesome. You know,
here's what I'll do. If I if I want to look, kick it old school, I'll drink some really cheap, like Mickey's malt liquor or something. And if I want a more modern twist, I'll drink some of the highbrow craft brew. So I'll still listen to the same record, but I'll kind of, you know, put my own twist on it. That'll be my A&B.
I will say with Ceremony is I'm interested in this record. I dig that it's a very limited release, and they say we're only pressing it one time, which is kind of cool. I mean, it's a good marketing thing, because I mean, I bought it the day they announced it. I didn't even think about it. But I thought the synth version, I mean, I thought In the Spirit World Now was very good. However, I thought the songs all could have used a little bit more work. They were all like 3 or 4 minutes long, and they started exactly the same way they ended. And I thought they could have progressed the song. I felt like they could have put another 4 more weeks of work in that album, and it would have been a lot better album. Although I think it's a good album. I think the synth version is actually sounding pretty cool and pretty weird. And honestly, it just sounds to me like kind of aggressive 80s music, 80s dance music, you know, kind of like, I don't want to say Flock of Seagulls, but, you know, like Gary Numan or even like Modern English or that kind of thing. So I dig it. I do wonder if it's too cute, though. I was somewhat annoyed with Ceremony when people were talking about In the Spirit World. Now they're like, oh, so you must have been influenced by like Gary Numan and New Order. And they're like, well, we're not really influenced by stuff like that. We're influenced by Bukowski. And then you hear the album and it sounds exactly like Gary Numan. You know
what
I mean?
So pretentious.
Yeah. And so I'm like, there's no shame in saying, yeah, you think Gary Newman's rad and you're doing your own taint on synth punk. Like, no one's going to be like, oh, they're just doing Gary Numan. You know,
what was Gary Numan played in like a 77 punk band that was already doing, was it Two Way Army? Was he Two Way Army?
Well, Two Way Army has two albums that they're both synth punk. However, before the first Two Way Army album came out, Gary Numan actually recorded a guitar version of the first album, which was released in the 90s as The Plan, and it rocks. And Gary Newman is cool.
Well, I was going to say, if they want to be cool and not like just totally embrace Gary Numan, maybe they could embrace Two Way Army. It's like, no, we're too cool for Gary Numan. We're only into Two Way Army.
Which is the same band.
Well, I know it, but I'm saying, you know, everybody wants to be a little cooler. You know, nobody wants to say, oh, we're influenced by Johnny Cash. They have to say, oh, we're influenced by this person who sounds just like Johnny Cash that you've never heard of, you know?
But on the other hand, you know, when a band's like, we love the Clash, like if I get a press release that says, you know, the Spankies love the Clash, I'm like, I'm not listening to this at all because I know it's going to be terrible.
But if the Spankies sent you the same press release, but they're like, the Spankies are really influenced by the Ruts, then you'd be into it.
There you go.
It's true. Anyways, I actually thought this record was cool, and honestly, it might be better than the original, honestly, just because it has seems to have a little bit more energy, a little bit more variety in each individual song, if you will. So, and also, like Ceremony, somewhat similar to Effed Up, has been doing alternate versions of their album. Their last album, they released a demo version of the album, and neither were that great. But the new one, I think this is a cool experiment. I think Ceremony, if we accept the fact that Ceremony's never going to do hardcore again, and they're over hardcore, which I don't mind. I just wish they weren't so flippant about it. I wish they were like, we think we've done pretty much all we can do with hardcore, so now we're expanding outward. Whereas they seem to have taken some glee in saying, you know, we're beyond punk now. Like, you have to say that. Anyways, I don't mean to diss on the band because I think they're a cool band, and I'm excited for this 12-inch, and it's a cool thing, man. The other thing is, Adam, I'm worried about synth. I've been listening to a lot of synth punk lately. I'm worried that we might synth punk ourselves out.
It probably doesn't, but no, but I have a theory about a lot of this stuff, and I feel like a lot of this, like a lot of the economics of being in a band, and let's say the realities of being in a band in this shitty year are all feeding into my interests in a lot of ways, which is to say, I feel like one of the reasons why you're hearing so many of these guys go and do synth punk stuff is you can hole away in your basement with a fucking synthesizer and a laptop, and you can make stuff. And in an era where there's like in an era where there was no money being a touring band unless you had a fairly significant following in the first place, let alone when you can't tour because there's a fucking super virus and all the clubs are closed. There is one of the outlets that you have is to you know, is to sit around with some goofy equipment and make weirdo basement music. And just like the flip side of that is, you know, you sit around in your basement and you record, you know, whole punk records yourself playing every instrument, but you're doing it to a bunch of shitty non-studio equipment. And you know what? What you've made ends up kind of sounding like the Spits. And that's cool to me. I can deal with that. So yeah, like it's like the economic realities of having to do a lot of this stuff is in a way feeding into the kind of music that I was seeking out in the first place. And I keep running into all this stuff where I'm like, this is rad. Why has no one talked about this? And it's just because, well, no one's talked about this because someone just made this in their basement and they're kind of stuck there.
Well, I guess if I had to choose between some guy making some synth pop in his basement and some mopey acoustic, like, I'm air quoting punk, acoustic punk, I guess I'll take synth music, Adam. So you may have won me over. I still don't really want that either, but I'm saying if I had to choose between some James Taylor punk rock wannabe and some Gary Newman wannabe, I'll take Gary Newman.
Yeah, I'll definitely take Gary Newman over James. let's play a song. Who's got a song to play? Adam, you got a song, right?
Yeah, here. This is in the exact spirit of what we have just talked about. So,
oh, great.
So, okay. So, well, here, I'll give you the choice. Do you want the people in their basement making weird music that involves some electronics, or do you want the weird person making punk rock in their basement, probably with the same amount of technology and budget? I don't know who I'm asking.
And you just describe like the same thing twice. What are the options again?
Drum like machine or no drum machine? Punk? That's your drum machine or none.
I will say, how long is the drum machine track?
Yeah, which song's shorter, Adam?
Drum machine is 1:44.
Right there.
Okay, so
any drum machine song under 3 minutes is great. Any drum machine over 3 minutes song sucks.
Well, okay. Well, here, this will appeal to you because the drum machine is almost used as a as an antagonistic element in this song. So there's a bunch of really fucking cool mean scrubby punk rock right now that's coming out of an island province in Canada called Prince Edward Island. So and there's all these and
famous for potato.
Yes, famous for their potatoes and their red soil. They have red soil there. I don't know why. Anyways, so there's a couple really.
John, we shouldn't have asked him which song was shorter. We should have asked him which intro was shorter.
Which intro was shorter? No, I got to contextualize this for the people. Anyways, so there's a couple.
Sorry, Jeff. Go ahead.
There's a couple really cool bands that are out of there that play like rip your face off punk rock music. One of them is called Warsh, which is sort of like a play on the local accent of the word wash. And there's a band called Antibodies that is fucking great. Antibodies is amazing. They have a full discography LP that's coming out right now on the UK label Drunken Sailor Records. But anyway, so Antibodies are great. So at some point this year, probably during the quarantine, someone from Warsh, Rosanna from Warsh, and Ben, who's one of the guys from Antibodies, they got together. They created this random band called Remote Control, and Rosanna sings and wrote all the lyrics, and Ben basically plays all the instruments, which is, as far as I can tell, he plays guitar and he has a drum machine that's behind him. And they released this little EP called the Remo Volume 1, and it's like at some points kind of detached and cool, and sometimes kind of frantic and angry, but there's just drum machines in the background of all the tracks, and it feels like they're fighting it at some points, and it's kind of interesting. So I'm gonna play the track where I think they're fighting the drum machine the most. It's called Judgment in the Barracks, and if you listen to this song, at a certain point it feels like the drum machine all of a sudden speeds up, and then the band is sort of forced to speed up with it, and it almost feels like someone kicked the tempo dial on the machine, and they just had to fucking deal with it. And so here you go. This is Remote Control out of Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, and the song is called Judgment in the Barracks.
Yeah.
and that was Remote Control and Judgment in the Back. Adam, what's the furthest north you've ever been in Canada?
Russia.
I don't know. I went to like Rayon-Noranda, and which is a town in Rayon-Noranda, which is a town in Quebec that I had to be flown to, and it's like 7 hours north of Montreal, which is, I think, on like the same latitude as like, I don't know, probably like Tillsonburg, Ontario. It's not that far north. You can get way further north than I've been. No, for Tillsonburg. No, fucking Tillsonburg. No, Timmins. Tillsonburg is south of me.
You went up there for work, or you were going to die in the, at the...
No, I somehow caught a few years ago. I guess I can tell the story because no one listens to this show. So, you know, our pal Mel K, she's like the Fat Records person in Toronto. You know, the press handler for your Fat Mics and your Jellybee offers and your whatnots when they come up to Toronto. She was hired to do the press for this Northern Quebec Music Festival, where she had to basically get like a junket of English Canadian journalists and bring them up there. And I somehow talked myself into being on that plane, even though I am not a professional or paid journalist. I'm pretty sure in Mel's words, she wanted someone to hang out. I'm not sure if that's true. I did some good work. There's good punk news writing about that music festival. But anyways, I went there. That was pretty far. But it's not like Canada's weird. As you go further west, all the major cities sort of like jack further north. So like I'm sure Edmonton or something like that is way further north than any of these places. But, you know, I can't go to Edmonton because right now I was supposed to be on a plane with my family to Edmonton for a wedding. But we can't because there's a virus. So fuck that. Yeah.
Have you ever been to Nunavut?
I have not. I do know a high school teacher of mine was dead set to be like one of the first white people to run across the border into Nunavut when that territory was carved out in like 1999 or whenever it was. So I got that connection.
Live there?
No, like people live there. It's like there's like an Inuit community that lives up there. It is.
I thought you were just screwing with him, John. I thought that was like a Star Wars thing or something.
It's a massive piece of land. It's huge. It's bigger than many states. No, there's Inuit communities that are up there. And it is, you know, there's not a lot of people that live up there. It is fairly unpopulated, but there are fucking bands from up there. There is a band that is I want to say like 1975, 77, 1980, something like that era, kind of like punky hard rock band that is from Nunavut that is called, oh God, what are they called? It's like, fuck, this is important. This band's name is important. Jesus
Christ. Looking at, Canadian aboriginal language types. It almost looks like Egyptian. That's interesting.
Northern Haze. Yeah, okay. There's a band called Northern Haze that's from up there, and they released like some stuff in like the late 70s or whatever, and then like everyone in that band like had some sort of horrible thing happen to them. And then they somehow reconstituted themselves like last year and put out an album like 30 years after whenever the original one came out. And it's kind of cool. The stuff that they put out. Yeah. So Northern Haze, they're from, Igloolik. Their original record came out in 1985. It is the first ever indigenous language rock album recorded in North America, according to some people on the internet.
I'm amazed at how clothing of the indigenous people from Northern Canada closely mirrors clothing from indigenous people of Northern Scandinavia and Northern Russia. Very interesting. Anyways, let's hit a few more stories.
No, and we're on track. What are you talking about?
listen, Jellybee Afro, he released a new song. It's called We Created Putin. He also released a video with it, and that's off his upcoming album called Tea Party Revenge Porn. I dug this track. I really like the reggae section on the second half, which I thought was rad. I think the track has got some good fire in it, and I love it when Jello's fired up. I thought the production was okay. I think I kind of wanted more production like the last couple albums he did with Jell and the Melvins record. Again, though, this is like a 4-minute song. It don't need to be like a 2.5-minute song. I just wish Jello would chop his songs in half, and no one would know the difference. You know, I just wish the songs were a little bit shorter. With that being said, this track is rad, and also, I mean, honestly, it's rad that Jello's not doing the acoustic guitar guy thing. It's cool that Jello's still on fire and blasting out like high velocity punk that's really harder than the Dead Kennedys were. So I think that's cool.
I think
I may have reached saturation. I may have reached saturation point with Jello and the Guantanamo School of Medicine, because I agree with the song length thing, man. But their records have always been like that. But you listen to like what he did with the Melvins or what he did with DOA, and the songs were long, but I think they were just more interesting. I don't know. I probably will enjoy this, but I'm having a hard time getting super excited about it.
I'm not sure if my opinion on some of this modern Jello stuff is colored by the fact that like I'm living with the politics that he's singing about versus when I was, you know, when I was a teenager and listening to the Dead Kennedys, like they were still singing about things that were foreign to me from a current events standpoint. Right. Like me listening to Dead Kennedys in the 90s, like I have no idea who Gary Brown is or why he's in this song.
Or Jerry Brown.
Was it Jerry Brown? See, I don't even know his fucking name, right? Like, Gary Brown's an upstanding citizen. I'm sorry, Gary.
He's a prick too.
I have no idea who these people are without sitting down to do the research for it. So I'm taking those songs as I'm hearing them as being like wow, like this crazy sounding band is angry about politics, and like I get the general thrust of what the politics are, but they're not singing about anything that I have like immediate knowledge of, so I'm not taking that baggage in with me. Whereas I listen to this and I agree with John, like Jello sounds like totally fired up on this, and in a way that is I think like kind of commendable, like I don't want to be like ageist, but like he sounds really fucking good for being like a late career punk guy. Like he doesn't sound flabby. He doesn't sound, you know, like he's just going through the motions. Like Jello's pissed off and as cranked as he's ever been. And that's great. But there's something about hearing him sing about Trump and Putin. And especially when you're looking at the video and he's got these videos coming out with the last few things that he's put out where they're just like, they're almost like clip shows of internet memes where they've gone and they've just like grabbed just like memes of like all of all levels of quality and cleverness. And some are not, and some are, and some are blunt, and some are just the most base level dumbness. And they're just like these clip shows of that. And
it's gotten predictable.
I can't help but look at that and think that like, this isn't like, I agree with him, but this isn't all that smart. And I don't know if maybe that would have always been my, this is what scares me. It's like, would that have always been my Dead Kennedys opinion if I was like immediately contemporary with what he's doing? Or is it just because I've listened to people yelling about Trump incessantly for 4 years and to see Jello do it, I'm just like, yep, thanks. Thanks for telling me about Trump, Jello. Like, didn't know any of that. Like,
that's what I'm saying. He needs a better angle or something. It needs to be a little fresher take or something.
You know what, though? Like speaking to the kids, so maybe we're not the target. Maybe the kids are the target. You know what I mean?
So maybe he's set for
that. But I think the thing is, John, with the Trump sucks things, listen, everybody thinks Trump sucks. I get that. But you got to have a little bit of a different angle on it or something, you know? I don't know.
This isn't just Trump sucks. It's talking about how American socioeconomic policies allowed Putin to rise to power. I think it's a little deeper than just Trump sucks, you know.
I guess.
I
may have reached saturation point. I don't, you know, listen, I have no problem with Jello. The guy's a national treasure, but I may have reached like a saturation point where I don't need this.
I guess where I'm looking at it from is that like, I feel like if I'm listening to, a lecture in the form of a song, I feel like I want to be learning something. And if I'm not learning something, then I'm just sort of on the cheerleader end of it. And I'm not as comfortable being there. And that's always why, like, that was why, like, Rage Against the Machine was so interesting to me when I was a kid. Because, like, if I wanted to, like, to
and they're not now.
Well, no, but I mean, they're not now because are they a band right now? I don't know.
Yes, they are. They reunited and ended Chuck D's. Oh, COVID.
Yeah, say if there's one upside of COVID, it canceled some of these bloated routine.
Okay, so modern day aside, when I was a teen and I was listening to Rage Against the Machine, right, I could have just did what I'm sure like a lot of people did, which is take them as just like another like loud band on the radio and appreciate them on that level, right? But I wanted to know what the fuck they were singing about. So I found it. I was doing research into like what was going on with like the Zapatistas and what was happening in Chiapas, Mexico and all this stuff to sort of like understand what exactly Zach was singing about.
Adam's in the card catalog. It's like pre-internet. He's like in the card catalog. He's got the microfiche out.
But like, I wanted the microfiche level, right? And it's why like the Beastie Boys politics appealed to me so much. Like I was like a member of their like Milarapa fund or whatever it was group that they put together that was like handing out like documents about what was going on in Tibet. Right. And it was like, oh, like if I want to clue into the politics that they're singing about, which I'm pretty sure I agree with, I kind of have to like understand this part of the world that they're singing about. And there was something about that that very much appealed to me, but just hearing something like this, where like, I don't necessarily disagree with anything Angelo's saying, but it's just like, but he's backing up the message with all of these, like, you know, like, I don't know, this might be my aversion to memes in the first place, but like, there's just like, just this barrage of like childish imagery of, you know, Trump being puppeted around like a buffoon. It's like, I don't look at any of that. Don't look at any of that stuff that he's putting in there and say, oh, this is really edgy, or this is really punk rock, or he's really like, you know, fucking with Trump's ego here. I'm just looking at all that shit and going like, oh, these look like memes that 16-year-olds made. Like, okay. But I bet you, and this is my hypocrisy in this, if I looked at the same video and it wasn't Trump, it was Reagan, and they had, you know, the shitty meme-y cutouts of Reagan dancing around, I wouldn't go, yeah, I've seen that. Okay, thank you. I would go like, ooh, this is pretty edgy. They're really ripping on Reagan here, right? Because I don't have any Reagan memories, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan. Exactly. Let's wrap this up. Adam, I'll let you take this one because you had an angle on this one.
Your motorcycle adventure?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know. Do I have an angle on it? I'll do it. Here we go. So
if by angle you mean Canadian guy looking down on us Americans, John, then yes,
I'm not looking down on any of you.
I'll take it back. Adam was going on and on. John made this viral.
My angle is that won't it be ironic that when punk news meets its demise, it's because Smash Mouth has sued us for defamation. There was an article that ran on Brooklyn Vegan, and in it, Smash Mouth, they weren't really a one-hit wonder, right? They were a several-hit wonder.
Maybe like three-hit?
Three-hit wonder. Anyways, the pretty goofy 90s-era alt-rock band was connected with about 100 new cases of the coronavirus. The band, they had recently played at the Sturgis Motorcycle Festival, which we talked about at the opening of this show, with a bunch of other bands that probably shouldn't have been playing in a live setting, including Night Ranger, the Kenny Wayne Shepherd Band.
Having nothing to do with social distancing, shouldn't be playing.
Buck Cherry, Lit, 38 Special, Quiet Riot.
Oh, 38 Special was there. Oh, dude, I totally pulled that out randomly earlier.
Also there, though, the Reverend Horton Heat, which is maybe a band some people respect, and Bone Thugs and Harmony. So all of these bands
What a weird combination.
This is a who is going to answer the email kind of lineup, right? So
just throw crap against the wall and see what sticks, huh?
Whoever we can get. So during Smash Mouth's set, and the festival as a whole. Attendees ignored social distancing guidelines. They were getting close with each other, refusing to wear masks defiantly. During Smash Mouth set in particular, lead singer Steve Harwell said, the quote is, "Now we're all here together tonight, and we're being human once again. Fuck that COVID shit." I don't know if he sounds like that, but that's what he said. So
could you do that in a Guy Fieri voice? Because that's what the guy looks like.
So, yeah. Now, yelling "fuck that COVID shit," John points out astutely in his article, is not enough to ward off the virus. And
that's not true. It's not true. Cursing kills it.
So a representative of the South Dakota Health Department said that they linked at least 40 COVID-19 cases directly to the rally. Meanwhile, the North Dakota Department of Health tracked 17 in-state cases to the rally and further stated that at least 103 connected cases have also been spread to Minnesota, Montana, Nebraska, Washington, Wisconsin, and Wyoming from this single event.
No, I was saying, go ahead, finish up.
All right.
I might go a different direction on this than you think. Anyway, go ahead.
Despite all of this, Smash Mouth has not had an occasion for reflection. Rather, following the new infections, they somewhat flippantly started posting Instagram photos of hate mail that had been sent to them, and they labeled it as fan mail. In the post, they also strangely included bits of smashed out Smash Mouth CDs, which John also points out can be purchased for 33 cents domestically on Discogs.
yeah, that's dollar bin stuff there, boy.
So Smash Mouth, which is a band that the internet has decided is amusing and make funnable. They went and they probably played this live event that maybe should have been postponed. And while it is not necessarily true that Smash Mouth personally breathed coronavirus into the mouths of their attendees, they definitely didn't help matters. So that all happened. John posted this amusing article, which really wasn't even our original. It was like based on Brooklyn Vegan's reporting there, just with probably some added snark. And
we bent it a certain way. And by we, I mean me, you know.
So John Post says, today at a certain point in the middle of my workday, I finished what I was doing. I'm like, hey, I want to go have a cup of coffee and kill a few minutes. I'm scrolling around on Reddit. I'm looking at the coronavirus subreddit, scrolling, looking for anything that's tagged good news, which is usually like where people are like reporting on like vaccine results or whatever. And what do I come across in the midst of the coronavirus subreddit is a punk news article being rapidly upvoted, and it's this one. And then it dawns on me later in the day that the automatic Twitter posting of this punk news article had something like, I don't know, at the time when I looked at it, you know, like several hundred comments, and each comment was just people using a Smash Mouth lyric in a goofy way to make fun of this situation. And John, in his own special way, maybe deservedly, you dragged this band's ass around the internet today.
But that was the idea. I mean, honestly, it was irresponsible. I thought it was funny. And I shouldn't even mention the comment. Like, the commenters never seemed to get the joke. You know what I mean? And they totally didn't hear, which I actually enjoyed that they didn't get the joke. But you know what? Smash Mouth should have been playing Sturgis. I mean, it was irresponsible. The whole thing was irresponsible. Not only that, though, is it's a weird world in which I dislike and even don't hate Smash Mouth, but I used to the song "Might as Well Be Walking on the Moon." Like, if I'm in the supermarket and I hear that track, I'm like,
it's
yeah,
sun, John. It's the sun. I'm grooving. Stop pretending like you don't know all the words.
To me, I was never anti Smash Mouth, and I thought they were maybe somewhat pleasant, you know, supermarket music, you know.
You're an all-star. Get your game on, John.
They're an incredibly inoffensive band, and I don't mean inoffensive in the term of public correctness. I just mean aesthetically, you know. And then they get up there, they're like, "We don't believe in Corona or whatever." And then not only after they got their spanking, and they should have went away for a while, just kind of hit and laid low, and everyone would have forgot about it. He gets on Twitter or Instagram. He doesn't need to, and he's like, "We're getting hate mail. Why should we be getting hate mail? Because you're making this whole thing last so much longer because you guys needed the $8,000 from Sturgis when everyone else is going broke because you guys can't risk getting your $8,000. So I was glad to give him a spanking. And that's that, Adam.
You know, the thing is, John, the thing I'm going to say about this is a typical non-story in a lot of ways, in that the truth of the matter is they were playing for a humongous crowd, way more people than they would under normal circumstances, right? Because it's this biker rally. And there's less people got it from this than starting the school year at, you know, University of Alabama, which has got all their social distancing in place. I really think it's a fun story, but I really don't think it's an important story. You know what I mean? I think all in all, it's just not that salacious.
I think it's an important story in the context that we need to shame people that are acting and extending this whole problem. You know, is it more important to have the schools more under control than a Smash Mouth concert? Yes. But listen, if this is what it takes to get people to be aware that coronavirus is a thing, and then all the other countries are getting it taken care of except for us, that could got to go see Smash Mouth. You know, Australia's kind of cool these days. Netherlands is getting its first shows back on the way because they sort of got it under control. Italy, who was the worst of the worst, has got it under control. If you can get a whole bunch of Italians to work together, then why can't we work together? I mean, getting Italians to work together is like the craziest thing in the world. If they can get it sorted out, how come we can't get it sorted out? And the answer is because we got to go see Smash Mouth. So,
well, but they also have already killed off the most vulnerable part of their population. I mean, it there's a lot of factors into it. You can't necessarily equate one to the other. I just, and listen, I'm not saying COVID's not a thing. I think it is a thing. I just think that they don't even really know for sure how you get it yet, John.
Well, I'm saying Smash Mouth having a concert ain't helping. You know what I mean?
It ain't helping anything. But I'm saying it seems like it's actually going to be.
The concert isn't helping anything.
But I think at the end of the day, the transmission is going to be less than people getting at the grocery store. You know what I mean? I think it's a fun story. I just don't think it's a really, I don't think there's a point to it other than a shame, you know, just trying to shame them. And I don't think the numbers really, I don't think the numbers qualify as the shaming is what I'm saying. I don't think it really works that way.
That's the problem, Tom, is that you're making the error in that just because it's 100 cases now, I mean, that's all they're going to be. That 100 becomes 1,000 next week, which becomes 10,000 in 2 weeks.
I don't care if it's 100,000. Tell me how many are dying. Tell me who are actually sick.
A lot of people are dying.
These college campuses where they're having these incredible testing numbers, but nobody's sick or dying. I mean, we've already killed off the most vulnerable part of our society. Anytime something new gets introduced in society, people die. I'm just, you know.
Grandma.
What's that? I do.
Oh. Is she still alive?
She is, and she's not staying home, and it's a choice.
We haven't killed off all, almost, you know what I mean? So from health,
not in poor health either, John, even among the old people, the ones, you know, a lot of people that
die. I mean, I don't know why we're arguing corona. I mean, the thing is clear that coronavirus is like a real thing and it's something we need to get control of.
I'm not saying it's not a real thing. I'm saying that nobody's telling us the truth about it because everybody's got a political agenda. The right, the left, everybody.
All right, well, then look to other countries where they don't have a stake in the game with regards to us. See how they're doing it. You know what I mean? So it ain't just America.
Listen, Josh, our governor has been very proactive about taking care of this stuff, allegedly. I mean, a pretty good lockdown or whatever, and our state has approximately the same population as Sweden. We've done exactly the opposite way that Sweden did it, and the death toll is about the same. So it's complicated, man. We don't even know what's going on with it.
I don't know. If everybody's doing it one way and it's generally working, that's my opinion, you know. Well, Adam, I'm moving to Australia or Netherlands.
There's starting to be some consensus. I agree. I mean, there is. But, you know, it's listen, man, I just think this story, like I said, it's a fun story, but I don't think it's a smoking gun. Everybody wants everything to be a smoking gun, you know. Oh, look, you know,
it's not a smoking gun. It's to let shame Smash Mouth because they're behaving disrespectfully. And so we did.
All right. I, for one, don't think Smash Mouth. I think Smash Mouth should be ashamed of a lot of things. I just don't know if the show is one of them.
I disagree entirely, but I don't think we're going to solve that tonight. Adam White.
Can it be
both? In what world do we live? Wait, what?
Like, can't Smash Mouth both be ashamed of all of their transgressions to date and this one?
Just be ashamed of their back catalog more than anything.
It's like a whole cornucopia of shame that they could just indulge upon. Anyways, all right, Americans, I'm gonna just not even engage in that. Where are we? What's happening? It's bedtime.
It's bedtime. Yeah.
All right. So, okay. Someone has time to play a song if they so want, especially because we don't listen to the song, so it doesn't affect our bedtime.
Which Smash Mouth song will we be playing tonight, John?
I will be playing. I'm trying to think if there's like a funny cover of Smash Mouth, but I can't think of one. You know, I meant to do mail this week when we had people talking about episode 500, but I forgot to get to it. So we'll do it. 500 mail. Thanks for sending us mail about episode 500. I appreciate it. You can reach the podcast at punknews.org, and I will play a lot of cool stuff's been coming out lately. I will play a song by a cool new release that just came out, and that release will be a song by the Dead Milkmen. If I move to the group to the group, if I move to the group to the group, if I move to the group to the group, if I move to the group to the group, if I move to the group to the group, if I move to the group to the group, if I move to the group to the group, if I move to the group to the group, have you heard it on the news about this fascist group thing? Evil men with racist views spreading all across the land. Don't just sit there on your ass, unlock that mighty chain dance. Brothers, sisters, shoot your best. We don't need this fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need no fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need no fascist group thing. History will repeat itself. Crisis point, we're near the hour. Counterforce won't do no good. Hot U.S., I feel your power. Hitler proved that funky stuff. It's not for you and me, girl. No, 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 no. Europe's an unhappy land. They've had the fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need no fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need no fascist group thing. Democrats are out of style across that great wide ocean. Reagan's president-elect, a fascist got in motion. Generals telling what to do, so stop your good time dancing. They train their guns on me and you, a fascist thing advancing. Brothers, sisters, lend a hand, increase our population. Grab that blue thing by the throat, let's throw it in the ocean. You're wielding that, you move a soul. Let's get out on the dance floor. Come out your house and dance your dance. Let's shake that fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need no fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need no fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need no fascist group thing.